Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Chomans, and while I have your attention, would you please be a darling and leave us a little review on your favorite podcast platform? Because it really helps other cinema fans find us. In case you came to our Celebrating Cinema screening of Charlie's Angels, we hope you had just as much fun as we did. We're going to be talking more about that in a little bit, but first, some fun things happening here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam this month. We have a retrospective of the French filmmaker and eternal icon, Agnès Varda, so don't forget to check our latest episode all about her. We're also still running our Studio Ghibli retrospective, as well as regular screenings of Edward Yang's classic Yi Yi to celebrate its 25th anniversary. And another 25th anniversary we have coming up is for the most fun retelling of Jane Austen's Emma by the name of Clueless. You might know it. We thought we'd take a look at some of our favorite chick flicks and discuss how we can make the genre great again. Here's Kiriko and Tom to tell you more.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, hello.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine.
So what have you been watching lately?
Last movie I saw was an early preview of One Battle After Another.
Okay.
By Paul Thomas Anderson.
Wow.
And I'm a bit trepidatious to say anything about this film because I have the idea that I'm going to just be spoiling and nobody wants to know anything about this.
Right.
So I'll leave it at it's fantastic.
And it's going to be in your cinema soon.
Yeah, we're going to screen it. It's going to be part of our Paul Thomas Anderson retrospective, which features all his films apart from Magnolia and Boogie Nights, which is really
a
shame.
Bummer.
Yeah, those are like the most important ones. But we can't screen them because we still don't have a 35mm projector, which hopefully we will have installed next year.
Thank you.
What was the last movie that you watched?
Yesterday I went to the cinema with Elliot.
Hey. And is that Elliot? Hey, he's right here.
And we went to see Daguerreotype by Agnès Varda. As you may know, I'm the super Agnès Varda fan.
Listen to the episode.
Yes, and I had seen Daguerreotype before, but I rewatched it. I also went to Paris this summer where there was an exhibit about her apartment, about Agnès Varda's apartment and all the films that she's made in her house and in her street. And of course, Daguerreotype is like the film that is about her neighborhood. It was fantastic. I highly recommend everybody to go see it. I have been a chick for all of my life. And I think the first moment that I knew that I was a chick was when I saw Charlie's Angels. Charlie's Angels is a 2000 movie starring the early 2000s Holy Trinity, Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore, and Lucy Liu. It is a film about three undercover spies with glitzy outfits who solve crimes for their mysterious boss, Charlie. That movie taught me many important life lessons, such as the strong power of hair flips. It imprinted in me the idea that every occasion needs a different outfit, and also that women deserve a place in the workforce. I also learned that kicking men was okay, but also that the highest people in power will still always be men. Charlie's Angels is also famously one of the worst films that has ever been made. It is the epitome of female objectification. Not only does it contain blackface, but also brownface and also yellowface. Roger Ebert gave it a half-star review and called it eye candy for the blind. Followed by
Jesus, Roger Ebert.
Followed by saying, Charlie's Angels is like the trailer for a video game movie, lacking only the video game and the movie.
Amazing.
Now, I think Roger Ebert's criticism on Charlie's Angels is not wrong, but it might also be the general consensus for chick flicks. Chick flicks are never to be considered great cinema. And I'm not saying that all chick flicks are good, because I also think that Crazy Rich Asians can be thrown in the bin right this minute. But I do think that they have a bad rep for no reason. Or actually, I think I do know the reason, which is that a lot of men hate women, and therefore all things women are considered to be bad. Because is the same people who think that chick flicks are bad also the people who love Christopher Nolan? Probably. Because what is a chick flick anyway? A film that's not about hate, but about love? Is a chick flick a film about a woman that thinks for herself? Is it a film that contains Really Beautiful Outfits? Is the Titanic a chick flick? Is Moonstruck a chick flick? Is the Before trilogy three chick flicks? I'm not sure what the definition of a chick flick is. I'm very happy to discuss it today, but I guess the fact that so many of them offend men is enough reason to love them. Chick flicks are peak pulp and the perfect territory for cinephile snobbery. And I think that it's time to make the chick flick great again, which is why I'm so happy that I'm joined here today.
This is why you're here. And this is why Tom is here, because he is a man, and he
likes chick flicks.
Yeah, you referred some points in your cold open. What really constitutes as a chick flick? Because why is there, for the longest time, has there been a negative connotation towards this term?
Right.
Because I remember when in the early 2000s, I had female friends who wanted me to see films like Mean Girls that I had never seen before. And I thought it was going to suck and then didn't.
At the time, you already thought it was cool?
No. By no means. Like, I think a lot of young boys are brought up not with the idea that some specific very girly culture things that are sort of emphasized or put to the forefront in films that are now dubbed as chick flicks are cool. I don't think you can expect from a 12-year-old child that hair flips, as you said, is amazing.
Mm. It's so extremely broad, because chick flicks, or films that are considered to be chick flicks, are crossing all genres.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have action movies chick flicks, romantic chick flicks, romantic comedy chick flicks, all of them.
Vampire movies.
Right. And then I thought, I guess it's just about films with a female protagonist.
Yeah, where the protagonist maybe has more, this feels so sad to say, but is more empowered than generally in films that are dominated by more male culture.
Yeah, so women who think for themselves.
But that's the thing. I don't think that a lot of the films that we now consider as chick flicks weren't made specifically, I think, with women in mind. Some of them clearly are. I mean, like Twilight, for instance, I do think that was generally made for 12-year-old 100%. Girls to show you, this is how a toxic relationship can be. Amazing. Yeah. He glistens in the forest.
But I loved it so hard. So
yeah,
I mean, you did
an amazing intro once for our Twilight Celebrating Cinema film club, where you called out all the guys.
All my ex-boyfriends. Exposed everyone. Okay, so not Twilight, but what other films can you think of that were not necessarily intended to be chick flicks, but then became one?
While doing some research for this, I thought it was very interesting that Breakfast at Tiffany's like popped up as the first sort of chick flick.
Mm.
Don't you just love it?
Love what?
Tiffany's.
I do believe love is found Andy Hardy.
I'd marry you for your money in a minute. You marry me for my money?
In a minute.
Which is bizarre, because that also is like the first iteration of a manic pixie dream girl.
Yes.
Which clearly is a very male-gazy trope of a, well, mostly troubled younger woman.
Mm.
And now that's considered like to be the sort of first real chick flick. And then why is that a chick flick? Is it because it's also like accepting about, very very accepting film about enjoying girly things?
As a chick, I relate deeply to Breakfast at Tiffany's. As a former manic pixie dream girl, I can also tell you that I think...
That's quite a thing to say about yourself.
Former.
Most of the chick flicks that I can think of are extremely tropey, right?
Yeah.
So Breakfast at Tiffany's is a trope, but then also the Charlie's Angels are like such a like a parody of a trope almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then even if it is film told from a female perspective, then still there is rarely, up until recently, was there a cinema language wherein women were not a trope. So even the films that are made for women, you still only can see yourself through the trope. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But isn't that a bit bizarre that then, like, these films that stand for...
It's so bizarre.
God.
It's so bizarre because then also...
A lot of them still are very much about objectification.
Yeah. I mean...
And sexualization.
Our friend
and
of the podcast, Bashabur, writes mm-hmm. extensively on this, about the effect that this has on women in their real lives, which is that as a woman, throughout all of the mirrors or cinematic mirrors that you have, you can only see yourself through the trope. So then mm-hmm. at some point you become the trope. You become Manic Pixie Dream Girl for some period of your life. Mm-hmm. And then you become the other trope. And then you have this continuation of different tropes still created by men up until the point where you're like, wait, but do I still have an identity or did I never have one because I've never been able to see myself through something that's not a trope?
But there have been instances of women making chick flicks. It's not necessarily that all these films are... I mean, Twilight is made by Catherine Hardwicke. Clueless is made by Amy Heckerling. But both of those films are bursting with tropes. Maybe it has to do with, like, claiming the trope. Like, it maybe it's sometimes there are situations where there is parts of... I know that I now really sound like a mansplaying female culture.
Tell me who I am.
This is this podcast. I can't do anything about it, really. I'm stuck here.
I love it.
This really no, listen. It really fascinates me because it's sometimes probably there are situations where these tropes that can be toxic are still, when they are claimed by women themselves, can still harness some sort of emancipatory power by flipping them or reliving them or giving them another...
And not even emancipatory power. Also, like, I mean, life is toxic. We as people are toxic. So I think there's also a lot of honesty and truth in identifying with the trope. Wait, I have a question for you.
Sure.
So from what I said in my cold open, like, and I think a lot of girls and women identify with this as well, is that you sort of see yourself through this tropey lens over and over again. Have you, as a man, had this experience as well, as a young boy growing up, watching films that you saw the trope, tried to copy it, make it your own?
When I was really young, when I was younger, I was infatuated with film noir.
Right.
Which is like in everything about film noir is wrong. Like female characters are portrayed as helpless or femme fatales, conniving bitches. And male characters are portrayed as either incredibly honorable and
very cool
and incredibly cool and smoking all the time and pants that are covering your belly button.
And you adopted that as a 12-year-old.
14-year-old, yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God!
Yeah, no,
I love that.
Yeah, no, I I'm not gonna go.
Nobody
into this,
understood
but,
you in class, right? You
yeah,
were that guy.
If anybody who saw me wearing black turtlenecks on high school is watching this, please don't comment.
Look at me now!
Look at me now! Still wearing black. I mean, these things reflect back on you, right? I think and even in that, there are like tropes that you can sort of latch onto for some period of your life and think like, oh, this is really cool. I'm now, this looks really cool. Should I be that? And then later on in life decide, oh, wait a minute. That's some weird heightened reality seen on movies that makes no freaking sense or doesn't gel in real life. And then give it a place in your own identity and pass on.
Or acknowledge that it's so cool and that it should stick to whoever you've become because made you
sure.
to the person who you are today. And
no,
then,
that,
you know.
No, that I agree with. I mean, I still think that there are things that I saw in older, more machismo culture depictions that are still part of me. I'm just not a dick about it.
Right.
You know,
some may say.
Some people would say that, yeah.
From my experience, I had the opposite of where I would watch... So I'm a different generation.
See what you're doing there.
My teenage years were full of Marvel films. That's kind of what I would go to. They'd be very action heavy. And I don't
really?
Think I ever identified with any of the superheroes because it seemed so beyond the realm of imaginability that I could adopt their personas or something. So I related much more to what we consider chick flicks or... Mm-hmm. In that respect, like I always enjoyed watching them.
How did you identify to the chick flicks? And what films are we talking about?
Well, I wonder if I would say High School Musical is kind of a chick flick.
Oh my God, I remember you mentioning this years ago.
I'm that guy. But also like rom-coms, so like 10 Things I Hate About You, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, this kind of stuff.
Right.
And I think, I don't know why I always enjoyed those films and sort of related more to
because you're a sensitive boy.
Yeah, I think it must be something like that.
Mm-hmm. But also the guys are very sensitive. Like, I think that's also the power of a chick flick, right? It's it's maybe the first manifestation of sensitive men who are, you know, open for romantic love out in public. I mean, that's mostly romantic comedies, but like the breakthrough point in most of these romantic comedies is the point where the man is not embarrassed of showing his love for a woman anymore, which is, you know, maybe the first tiny step in fighting patriarchy in some way.
It's also very interesting that that's a reason why I think there is a lot of men who do not enjoy these films, because they might not feel comfortable, which, by the way, is also fine, but come on, feel comfortable with their own vulnerability or their own feelings. Or I don't necessarily think that this is only about... But because that's funny, if you watch, look at it from a lot of them are romances, like Notting Hill, for instance, which I now had to think about because Elliot was speaking. sorry, I want to firmly apologize to Elliot for making that remark. The readers of Horse and Hound.
Oh,
the readers of Horse and Hound.
Is that just how your apologize. Brain works? Like, Elliot says hi, and you're like, Notting Hill, man, that was a good
I hear
movie.
You, Grant. I hear you, Grant. No, sorry. That's also a trope, and I'm sorry, I want to firmly apologize. you're more than just British. You're also just a very sensitive boy sitting in front of a man asking him to love you. I have no idea what my point was, but there's a sort of emotional liberation, I think, sometimes in these films that some men... find very daunting or stupid or flat or maybe hard to accept. Maybe a lot of men are just not romantic. I don't know.
Or jealous that what they see happening on screen doesn't
or afraid.
Yeah.
I think, and I said Christopher Nolan in the intro because we were just talking about it earlier, but I really do think that Christopher Nolan has a lot to do with this.
Oh boy, here we go. Well, the comment section can like pop off again. Horrible take comment. Yeah.
Let me explain this. I think not wanting to engage with romance or with sensitivity, with opening yourself up emotionally, very oftentimes results in this idea that you need to be like complex in a very different way, which is oftentimes intellectually. And then I think Christopher Nolan like feeds into this people, into most often men, who like are so afraid of wanting to get in touch with themselves and their feelings that it does like the complete opposite thing, which is like complicate life in all these ways that are by no means emotional, but just like complex, but in a like technical, scientific type of way. It gives them like the feeling or like the validation, and also this strong need to like be able to hold on to something and be complex in a very different way. That it's
for all my Christopher Nolan boys, it's okay to not want to be vulnerable. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes, I agree.
Okay to think that staying within your sort of own intellectual bracket and like it's fine.
Agreed.
It's
agreed.
Okay.
I agree with you.
Oh, it's fine if you don't love chick flicks. There's nothing wrong with that. And that you really, really love Christopher Nolan and Michael Bay and films that are clearly made for 12-year-old boys. There's nothing wrong with that.
That you did something there. 12-year-old boys. No, you can be what you can be.
Oh, hold on, no, it's fine for
there's
you.
No judgment.
No, I mean,
there's like, no judgment. There's just two types of people in the world.
There's two types of people in the world.
Tom, what is your favorite chick flick?
Yeah, I think the definition of a chick flick is so.
But we have
murky.
Now established a film about a woman that thinks for herself. I'm gonna hold on to that one.
I think the issue with the chick flick term itself is that it seems to still sort of denigrate these films.
Absolutely.
It's still not like a sort of stamp of approval.
No.
So the movie that I'm now going to say, yeah, I think is then would fit these weird tropes, but also the more sort of positive side of it, then I would say When Harry Met Sally. But that is generally just considered to be like a rom-com classic.
Right.
A faceless guy rips off your clothes, and that's the sex fantasy you've been having since you were 12. Exactly the same.
Well, sometimes I vary it a little.
Which part?
What I'm wearing.
That's a chick flick.
But why?
Because it's a woman that thinks for herself alongside a man who also thinks for himself.
Yeah, so because of the fact that it's... that Sally is a real character with flaws that can also be her strengths.
Yeah.
Like, and I think the entire sort of I'm ordering my dressing on the side is always like portrayed as that makes her annoying, but it also really makes her that character and an amazing individual.
And I think it speaks exactly to this vulnerability that we were speaking about earlier. Like, to what extent do you as a human open up and make yourself vulnerable to the world or put up a shield?
As a woman or as a man or both, as anybody?
Both of them. Yeah. Both of them. Yeah. Like, their relationship is exactly about that, no? It's the play of vulnerability.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, totally. I think the moment that they can accept each other is the moment that they're both letting go of a lot of shit around them.
Mm-hmm. And pressure, I think also... Sally, but also Harry. I think both of them, I wouldn't trope them. I wouldn't be able to trope them.
No.
Which is quite exceptional, especially for a film that's, I mean, not old, but also not that new.
Yeah. Now I need to circle back to my firm apologies. to Notting Hill.
Yeah?
I remember seeing that for the first time and then...
You were a teenager?
The thing always is, I think, with a lot of romantic comedies is that I remember when I was younger and I'm watching these films and still thinking like, this is not really for me. I do see why it's good, but it's also, it's not necessarily made for me.
Mm.
I've come back to that statement. I think Notting Hill was very much made for me.
Now in retrospect. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That turning point, is it now during this recording or like?
Well, I've come to realize that
Was there like a moment in your life where you as a person thought, oh, rom-coms are also made for me?
Jeez,
and what can we learn from that?
That is a good question, though. I don't know. To make it more broader, I think that there was a point just before I started working here. I had a lot of friends who were very much into the female representation, who taught me a lot. And also in my programming here, it's always been like, I don't know why. I've always been fascinated with the portrayal of women on screen and the evolution of female empowerment on screen or not, or just the...
You've had a lot of female representation programs here.
Yeah, because I do think it's important, but also just because it, the way that the gaze works in cinema is, I find very interesting how it depicts women. And most of my favorite films are films that do exactly that. Like Vertigo is a film about a man looking at a woman, thinking it's another woman. There's this othering.
Is Vertigo a chick flick?
If you think a woman should die for them to become who you want them to be, yeah, then it's very much a chick flick. But I don't think that necessarily constitutes as being very healthy. Yeah, then you could say, like, is Gone Girl a chick flick?
Oh, my God.
I do think there probably are women that think that Gone Girl is a chick flick.
I think
that's
so,
that's
how
too. You stand up to a man.
Because that's also...
By killing yourself.
She definitely thinks for herself.
Yeah, she sure did. Oh, my God. Amazing Amy.
That is a profound chick flick. Because that's also the thing, like, being a chick has many sides to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not just the glamour. You know, coming face to face with your dark thoughts. Okay, so the chick flicks that we've spoken about until now are mostly these late 90s, early 2000s films, which I think is what most people consider to be peak chick flick time period.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that it is that moment in history that, why were they blooming then? What was it about those times that were so chick flicky?
I think it's an interesting question, and I find it hard to judge, because there clearly are these films, like for instance, like Coyote Ugly or something.
Yes.
That we haven't mentioned yet.
Coyote Ugly? Why would you name your bar that?
Oh, because Cheers was taken.
What's a movie like that, where it's like women dancing on a bar and being very rowdy? Was that made specifically in mind by a studio thinking like, oh, this...
Women are going to love this.
Women are going to love this.
Yeah.
But then still that film has such a weird and also, let's be honest, a bit stupid way of telling its story. It's clearly like a bit of a schlocky film.
Mm.
How do you make a film like that, like specifically tailored towards a younger female demographic, and have those films that are being made now for the same younger demographic, have those films changed to an extent that maybe chick flicks don't really feel like chick flicks anymore right now? I find it hard. This is maybe like a question on a question now. But
Yeah. Something that I really like about the early 2000s is that because it was the new millennium, there was this beautiful sense of looking back on everything that had happened the 50 years prior.
Mm.
So history became in some way costumey. Like everything became a costume. And like the 60s were sort of like, yeah, you can just put on a 60s dress and then you are in the 60s. And yeah, you can just play around with the idea of being a ho-oh and you don't have to be one. It's a it's a costume. And also like this idea that all the things had to be in three. Like as a woman, like you have Charlie's Angels, of course, but then you also had Destiny's Child, the Sugar Babes. And they were, all of them are just like playing around with this idea that everything can be put on. This is not necessarily an answer to your question, but I do think that because there was this playfulness and this sense of irony towards the past and also towards womanhood in itself, I think then it became this playground for all of these films where there was this big sense for women that the trope is a trope and then you can just
play around with it because
it's a new millennium.
You can have fun with
it. We can wear whatever we want.
Yeah.
Whether that be, you know, the super hoary thing or the I'm an intelligent spy.
Let me now take this small moment to name one of the biggest influences on my life. This is not in any way a joke, but I was a huge fan of the Spice Girls.
Love that.
Which is, you named the Sugar Babes, but it's the same thing. The Spice Girls movie is clearly one of the worst films ever made.
I don't think I've ever seen it. I was never a Spice Girls girl.
Oh my God, it's such a dumb film. But there's so much fun to be had in that film. Is there maybe a moment there in the early 2000s where there is a sort of liberation to then play with these tropes and...
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Spice Girls
But wait, like, it wasn't like the feminist wave had ended, right? It's not like, oh, and now we can just eat Chupa Chups and we have Jerry kind of showing her boobs and Mel C doing backflips, all fun and games, yay, girl power.
A lot of people considered that as a form of feminism. And I think it in some way is. Like, I'm thinking about now this idea that you have these five Spice Girls who each represent a different side of life. And then that side of life becomes your life. It's very like, I choose my costume for today in Clueless. Where you just choose something that you are for that day. And that is your liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that idea is... Because it's a bit silly and people know that it's silly.
And of course, the thing was more than it is now probably with these films that, I mean, the female Ghostbusters film kind of did the same thing.
Yeah.
But the costumes are not the costumes anymore. I think like, the Spice Girls is a very good example that you can have your female empowerment be high heels and a black dress.
Yeah.
Because you want to be Posh Spice.
Yeah.
And if you want to do backflips, you can be Mel C. And if you, so it's, I think that.
And if
now,
you
want to
be a bored bitch who hates life, you can be the Ghost Road Girl. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If women up until that moment in time had very limited cinematic options to what they would identify with, then I think it's a fun thing to identify with.
But isn't this also a bit how our view on diversity has changed? I think that maybe also has to do with it.
What do you mean?
I think that if you look now at, for instance, a film like the sort of move now that, okay, this movie needs to be completely a female cast, then a female cast is just going to be taking off other boxes that politically fill in or socially politically fill in different subsets.
Right.
Which the Spice Girls, in a way, also did.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Yeah.
But the costume was different, or the portrayal, or the, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds a bit sloppy what I'm saying, but...
No, you're saying it's a limited form of liberation because it's just, it's superficial.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the real liberation comes, and now I want to move to newer films, at the point where you see female leads who can fail in life. Mm-hmm. And that is something that can be shown on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to Frances Ha.
Ah!
Ah!
Oh.
Frances Ha! Which I think is very much a chick flick.
Mm-hmm.
And revolutionary in its own right, because it's about a woman who is struggling with the idea of what trope she wants to belong to and fails at them.
What do you do?
It's kind of hard to explain.
Because what you do is complicated?
Because I don't really do it.
It's a 2012 movie with Greta Gerwig, directed by Greta Gerwig. Written by her husband. Yeah. I think it's her debut film.
Directed by Noah Baumbach.
Oh,
they wrote it together.
Okay.
And she stars in it.
Right. And is it her debut everything? I think it's her debut everything.
Debut everything.
And she plays the role of a girl in New York, failing in many, many different ways in life. Like, she has complicated relationships with the people around her. She wants to become a dancer, but isn't really, you know, making it happen career-wise. And she's losing her best friend, who she used to, you know, she's been friends with forever. And then it's just the struggle of what it means to grow up and be in your late 20s. It's a film about self-destructive behavior just growing exponentially.
If there's one thing she's struggling with, it's herself.
She's like, yeah, she's digging a hole under her feet, and it's just going deeper and deeper. It's a very honest film, and I think it really shows what Greta Gerwig, but also her husband, can do best, which is like this very true portrayal of what it means to be a human struggling. And yeah, I think that is, for me at least, the first chick flick that I can think of that moves beyond the idea that a woman is a chick, and that a woman is also a person.
Yeah, a real person.
Yeah.
That can be stupid and fun and annoying. Yeah. And because I remember the first time seeing Frances Ha, I thought it really takes you half an hour to think like, oh wait, but you're just almost a real person. Which sounds a bit weird. But then you start appreciating the fact that, or you don't, no, maybe you don't even start appreciating the fact that she's annoying. She is annoying, but that's fine.
Yeah. Because then you realize, oh wait, I'm also annoying
also
sometimes.
Super annoying. Yeah, exactly. How does this lead into Lady Bird, for instance? How does this now?
I don't like Lady Bird, sorry.
Because I think that maybe what is happening, if Frances Ha is to be considered a chick flick, which you have now done so.
Yes.
I think that means that not me, but like women are reclaiming the term.
Yes.
Correct? So it's now the controversial nature or the denigrating nature of the term of saying like, oh, this is these high heel movies, if you know what I mean, can now be just claimed as a thing where you can say these are films that celebrate to an extent or maybe even satirize in a accepting way what it is to what womanhood constitutes as.
Mm.
Because I have the feeling that that's what's happening with this term, that there's this...
Maybe it needs a new name, chick flick. We need to come up with a new name.
Yeah.
That's for the end of the podcast. We'll think about it.
Send in your suggestions. Yeah, so after Lady Bird, she made that one called Barbie.
Well, she made a lot of things in between also, but she is sort of like the female director of now making the big films about women.
Yeah,
for
but no,
women.
But the funny thing about Barbie is that it does really lean into the superficial aspects that some chick flicks have been known to have.
Yeah.
Or known to glamorize.
Yeah.
And then it completely flips it on its head, of course.
I think it plays into the nostalgia of these 90s, 2000s films big time, which makes it...
And towards Barbie, right? I mean, Barbie like the sort of... Isn't Barbie like the real chick flick avant la lettre itself? Like, it's such a... Yeah, it's like the icon of female...
Cameron Diaz before Cameron Diaz was born. What's your top three chick flicks? Give it to the audience so they have something
I think they're all 90s comedies, really. Romantic comedies. I mentioned When Harry Met Sally. I mentioned Notting Hill. And I see something happening here. There is a through line. I think the other one is Pretty Woman.
And what's the... I missed the line.
Oh, it's Julia Roberts. No, I mean, the other one is Meg Ryan, I know. But I thought like, oh my God, there's two that feature Julia Roberts. I really miss Julia Roberts.
Yeah, what is she doing? After Eat, Pray, Love?
She's about to star in Luca Guadagnino's new film.
Yeah, After the Hunt. Yeah.
Sorry.
Watch out, now all the Guadagnino boys are going
to... Come for me. I mean, I'm ready to fight.
Fuck us up in the comment section.
I'm ready to fight. You think that's real feelings?
Not ready to fight over Luca Guadagnino. No, she's going to be starring in Luca Guadagnino's After the Hunt. Yes, correct.
That's nice.
So she is still doing things. But Pretty Woman, also an incredibly...
Beautiful.
Beautiful, but also... This is a woman as a beautiful sex worker trope and an 80s Richard Gere guy played by Richard Gere.
I mean, it's nice to dream, you know? Like, give us some fantasy also. I think that's also the beauty of these 90s, 2000 films. It gives you something to dream about, even if it's wrong. Cancel me.
This is the thing. This is also like accepting the sort of fallibility of things, I guess, or the fallibility of of your own tropes. Or,
I
think that's I think that's what my takeaway from this podcast recording is, that it's interesting that you can claim your own tropes, even if those tropes are aghazed by somebody else that, you know, maybe might not be positive, but that you can, in sort of reclaiming it, you don't have to change it. You don't have to change yourself. You can just... accept it.
It gives you also a better understanding of who you are and who you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about something similar when we did a recording on Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. How it's also just very formative to look at beautiful people on the screen and understand that you're attracted to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a similar way, to see a trope and to understand that is something that you want is very important. Also, if it's just like a beautiful whore and you're like, I'm serious. Like, if you see these Charlie's Angels and it's the dumbest thing ever, but you're like, wow, fuck, that's hot and powerful. Like, that's, I guess that then, if that's who you want to be, then, right? That's honest and real.
Yeah. And freeing in some sort of way.
I think so. Yeah.
Any female directors you'd like to see make a chick flick today?
That's a fascinating question, though. If the fact that it takes so long for us to respond, it goes to show that sort of film... I mean, there are a lot of good female directors, but they're making very different films.
Very
like
different.
Julia Ducournau's chick flick, I don't necessarily want to see. And I mean, I think Celine Sciamma could be... I mean, does girlhood constitute as a chick flick? I don't think so, but Portrait of a Lady on Fire is not a chick flick.
Is it not?
Oh, boy, here we go. Well, on the next episode of Celebrating Cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe not a director, but Tilda Swinton. Something she's never done.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I especially don't want to see films anymore, maybe, that see this thing as in an executive, you know, meeting room on a flipboard where it says chick flick. And then everybody says, yeah, we're going to make a film and it's going to be about these women. And then they find, again, Paul Feig or somebody to make that film.
Mm.
And it's this funny sort of rehashing of what these tropes are doing instead of it really owning the, you know, the real nature of it. I think there are a lot of films being made that kind of sort of try to copy the Charlie's Angels thing, but then also the stupidity of it.
Yeah. And then it doesn't work.
Completely misses the point of what that, and also what nostalgia has brought to these films, etc.
Yeah.
But it really sort of tries to rehash that as this sort of corporate new thing.
Yeah, I agree. I know that this is the nostalgia podcast, but I think part of growing up is also like understanding that nostalgia is, it only gives you pleasure to a certain extent, and then it stops.
Oh my god, that was so depressing.
Yeah, but that's kind of, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm very excited for the new Devil Wears Prada. I have high hopes. I loved the first one so much. I think it's the film I watch. I always watch it when I'm sick, so I think it's the film I've watched the most in my whole life.
Final question.
Yes?
You said in your statement, mate, chick flicks great again.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
There needs to be a development and a progression of what the chick flick is rather than just these throwbacks of what they used to be and what they used to be for us back in the day. Whereas we still need to continue thinking about what the chick wants and how she's presented in the flick. And therefore, I would like to say, make chick flicks great again.
I would just like to add, because this, now I suddenly realize what name I was looking for. I am very sad that Nora Ephron is not alive anymore. Because I think that Nora Ephron, who wrote When Harry Met Sally and directed Sleepless in Seattle. I think she really understood what it is to be a woman and what it is to be romantic and what you want from a sensitive, but also a sensitive guy that's also just really just himself, not in any way more or less or whatever.
And we have a new name now. We need to rename chick flicks.
Yeah.
I've just come up with it.
Oh, here we go.
It's Cuntikinos. I think that's how we need to... That's how we need to rename them.
And you know,
because they used to have a bad rep, and now we can, you know, reclaim...
New term for a new generation, I guess.
The chick flick. I want to see them.
Yeah, well.
You can go watch Clueless now being shown at Lab 111. Reason why we're doing this podcast.
Right, that's a beautiful film.
As if.
Ew, get off of me! Ugh, as if!
Clueless is screening all through September here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam, and you can find your tickets at lab111.nl or through the show notes.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. If you love what we do, support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF. Thank you.